Huh?
If you're the police, where are your badges?
Badges? We ain't got no badges. We don't need no badges. I don't have to show you any stinking badges.
Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown.
What we've got here is failure to communicate.
I'm a man. Well, nobody's perfect.
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
He wins, he takes the car. I win, I take his finger. Is that so strange?
Leiningen, you're up against a monster 20 miles long and 2 miles wide, 40 square miles of agonizing death. You can't stop it.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
Round up the usual suspects.
Silent Breed is people!
Wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast about movies. All kinds of movies. Crime movies, science fiction movies, horror movies. Movies with cool actors you've never heard of in them. Movies where CGI stands for criminals, girls and ice picks. Classic movies, cult movies, and any other movie Terry wants to rant about as long as the movie is more than 20 years old. You can find the podcast website at paleo-cinema.com. The voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can email or send MP3 voicemails to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast usually contains swearing and is probably not safe for work unless you work in a brothel or a David Mamet film.
Okay, so what's up, Internet? This is Terry Frost and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 85, the fourth anniversary of this sad and sorry enterprise. So 4 years of doing this thing. And they've been a weird and wild 4 years, a lot of changes, a lot of weirdness. And I actually started this podcast as I was kind of diving into a severe depression. And since then, it's only got better. The podcast saw me through that. The support of listeners saw me through that. I've now got the movie gig at ABC Darwin. I'm enjoying what I'm doing. I've met a lot of incredible people through this podcast and through other podcasts. And in general, things are going majorly groovy. So I hope everybody out there is doing well. The weather's actually quite warm tonight, which is really nice. We've just dipped out of winter, as you know. And today was about 22 to 25 degrees and sunny and all sorts of stuff, so all going well. One of the other things I should mention is that if you go on Facebook now and type in the Paleo Cinema Cafe with a dash in it, there's a kind of Facebook page for Paleo Cinema that I'm updating regularly. I'm putting YouTube clips on and posting other updates and things like that, so you might want to check that out. So if you could type in the Paleo Cinema Cafe, or you can go from my Facebook page to that, and please friend me up if you haven't done it already. There's a lot of stuff happening around the house. We've got a renovation loan for the house, so we're redoing the kitchen, and we went out and looked at the kitchens and signed a contract today and all that sort of thing, and we've got to do a lot of things around the yard and other stuff like that. So there's a lot of things going on big time around the place, and it's all quite fun. It's a little bit challenging, a little bit daunting, but ultimately it's going to improve this place no end. So I hope everybody is cool. I shouldn't really say that too much. I know you all are. You're incredibly cool and wonderful people. What have I been watching? Let's do that. Let's do some what I've been watching. I did check out Super 8, the J.J. Abrams film. Now, I've got to fess up right from the start. Not a big fan of the 1980s films that it references. Never liked E.T. Did not like E.T. a bit. As I've said about this film before, I don't mind a movie that seduces me. I love movies that seduce me into an emotional state that the movie makers want to engender. I don't like a movie that sticks its hand down the front of my pants and tries to jerk me off. And I found E.T. that it was way too obviously and crummily manipulative. And I know that that was one of the movies that Super 8 was referencing. Super 8, it's a competent film. It doesn't do anything we haven't seen before, though. Some good acting, some really good acting in it. But in general, why bother is pretty much my answer to that film. I'm sure that other people liked it, but for me, it was not worth the hype, and it's possibly one of the reasons why it didn't have the accolades that the people who made it really wanted for it. So what else have I watched? I watched The Bridge on the River Kwai. I got Ivor and I got, this was a movie I'm going to talk about on the radio with ABC Local Radio in Darwin. But Ivor got, and I got last minute news that he was moved to Sunday morning shifts for a few weeks. He's quite stressed out in his job. He's spent a lot of hours doing stuff for ABC Darwin. They've said, back off for a few weeks, take a little break, do the Sunday morning shift and chill out. And he's doing that. So I'm back on recording on the 30th of September, but that one will be played 6 days later. And what the movie we're going to do then is The Bridge on the River Kwai. And yeah, I liked it. I'm not going to talk too much about it because I'm doing it for the radio. I may even eventually do it for the podcast at some stage. But a really interesting movie. I got the new restored edition on Blu-ray very cheaply at a department store, and it's eye-poppingly sharp and beautiful. I've never seen it, the movie, as clearly as this before. And yeah, of course it's recommended. It's got William Holden, who's my main man because he and I share a birthday. And I do like William Holden as an actor as well. So I saw that. I saw a few of the Thin Man movies with William Powell and Myrna Loy and Asta the dog in them. And they're great. I just love them. I hadn't seen them before, but I downloaded a torrent of all the Thin Man movies, and they're great. I saw The Thin Man, After the Thin Man, and Song of the Thin Man so far, which has an actress that we're talking about this week, Gloria Graham, in it. So, yeah, if you get a chance to see them, they're beautifully witty movies. Myrna Loy and William Powell play off each other incredibly well. It's just a joy to watch the two actors having such fun with each other, and not in a way that you've got to find the hidden camera video of. So I really kind of grooved on those. I saw Chud, Cannibalistic Human Underground Dwellers, a good old 1980s horror film. It's got Daniel Stern in it. It's got John Hurt in it. And, yeah, it's a bit of fun. It's quite good at what it does, and I know a lot of people are incredibly fond of it. So I kind of dipped into that just to have a little bit of a chill-out movie, and not too bad. I did see a movie I've already talked about in the podcast, The Young Girls of Rochefort. I rewatched that because I just love Michel Legrand's music in it. It's got Catherine Deneuve. It's got her sister Francois Dorliac in it. It's got Gene Kelly in one of his last good roles. Yeah, and it's a joyous celebration of cinema and music and love and romance and the city of Rochefort. So good stuff. Did see The Demon Seed, the movie about a computer who rapes Julie Christie. And the computer's voiced by Robert Vaughn. That's a sleazy little film. It's interesting, and the computer technology is a kind of kludgy 1970s computer technology, but it's interesting to see what they're doing with it. So I watched that. And, yeah, it's got one of the most interesting computer rape scenes I've seen in a film. But, yeah, you've got to see that one with a group of people, I think. It really does have features of interest. I did see Blade Runner as well, because I talked about Blade Runner on the radio. I saw it on Blu-ray. And Blade Runner, yeah, a beautifully layered and textured world in that movie. And some good acting roles. Rutger Hauer, of course, is good in it. Daryl Hannah's good in it. Joe Turkel's good in it. Harrison Ford and Sean Young, not so good. There's a kind of emptiness at the center of that film that I really have a little bit of a problem with. So, yeah, I saw that, and I don't know whether I talked about seeing this one last time around, but I saw a movie called Bedroom Mazurka, which is a 1970s Scandinavian sex comedy. I think I talked about that, so I won't go any further than that. I've seen a few other things, but nothing really that jumps out at me at the moment. But that's pretty much what I've been watching, a nice, good range of interesting and sometimes not so interesting stuff. I do have Attack the Block to watch after I finish the podcast. It's my Finish the Podcast reward movie for this time around, and I'm looking forward to that. Probably as an antidote to Super 8, because I've heard a couple of other podcasts, I think Girls on Film mentioned this, that they were comparing Super 8 versus Attack the Block and said that Attack the Block was much superior to it. To be honest with you, it doesn't have to do a lot to be superior to Super 8, even though Super 8 technically and in some of the acting was a great film. Yeah, okay, so yeah, alien escapes from the US government, builds a spaceship, goes home. That's pretty much it for that. But yeah, I am looking forward to that and a few other bits and pieces, and I may have a little less time to watch movies in future for the next few months, because we are getting a lot of this household stuff done. And part of it involves gutting the kitchen and the area where we mostly watch movies in the house, because there's a kind of open plan area in the house. We've still got another area with a Blu-ray player and a TV set, so I should be able to still do that. But the disruption and moving shit around aspect of the ongoing renovations may kind of curtail things a bit. I hope they don't too much, but they might a little bit. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I come back, I haven't actually said what I'm talking about, have I? Which was a bit remiss of me. I do apologise for that. I'm talking, it's the A to Z project. We're up to the eyes. And in this case, we're doing In a Lonely Place, Humphrey Bogart, Gloria Graham, directed by Nick Ray. And also, I Walked with a Zombie, the Jacques Tourneur, Val Luton film. I'm a little daunted by that one because it's such a well-known and popular film and being covered by so many podcasts and so many other people in the past that I'm going to be struggling perhaps to bring something new to it, but I'm going to give it a go. I mean, the rule here, of course, is bite off more than you can chew and chew like buggery. And before I do go on a break, I do have to thank Sal for redoing the intro. I thought 4th anniversary, now's the time to redo the intro with the new link to the blog, which is now paleo-cinema.com, since I got that domain. But thank you, Sal, for all your support in the last 4 years. I really do appreciate it. And I'm not saying I couldn't do this without you, but it'd be a lot harder and a lot bleaker without you. Walk is me. Shame and scandal in the family. Hey. Walk is me. Shame and scandal in the family. In Trinidad, there was a family with much confusion, as you will see. There was a mama and a papa and a boy who was grown, who wanted to marry and had wife of his own. He met a young girl who suited him nice. He went to his papa to ask his advice. His papa said, son, I have to say no. That girl is your sister, but your mama don't know. Hey, woe is me. Shame and scandal in the family. Hey, woe is me. Shame and scandal in the family. A week went by and the summer came down, and soon another girl on the island he found. He went to his papa to name the day. His papa shook his head and this time he did say, you can't marry this girl, I have to say no. That girl is your auntie but your granny don't know. Hey, oh, is me. Shame and scandal in the family. Hey, woe is me. Shame and scandal in the family. Now he went to his mama and covered his head. He told his mama what his papa had said. His mama, she laughed, she said, come and go. Your daddy ain't your daddy, but your daddy don't know. Hey, woe is me. Shame and scandal in the family. Hey, woe is me. Shame and scandal in the family. Hey, woe is me. Shame and scandal in the family. Hey, woe. That's what I like, a cheerful song about adultery. That was Lance Percival with Shame and Scandal. Now, the reason I'm playing that is because a totally different version of that song appears in the first of the two movies I'm going to talk about today, which is I Walk With a Zombie. The song was written by Sir Lancelot, a Jamaican calypso singer, who appears in the film and kind of acts as a kind of Greek chorus behind the main action of the film, and in a quite spooky and interesting way. So anyway, we'll do a little bit of the intro to I Walk With a Zombie. A lot of people know it, but for those who came in late, we'll kind of give it a bit of background on it. It's a 1943 horror film directed by Jacques Tourneur. It was the second horror film that producer Val Lewton did for RKO after Cat People. The movie was edited by Mark Robson and stars James Ellison, Francis D. and Tom Conway. Now, the only person to really take out of those three is Tom Conway, who happened to be the brother of George Sanders. And they sounded very similar, and they're both as suave as shit and had a career in film in the 1940s and 1950s. The Falcon movies starred first George Sanders and then his brother Tom Conway. And, you know, he was kind of a B-movie actor. He was tall and aristocratic-looking, had a pencil mustache, and really had a certain presence about him. Now, the interesting things I found about this film was 69 minutes long. It's not a long film, but it's packed with stuff. The plot line, basically, people have said it's Jane Eyre in Jamaica with zombies in it, really. But I'm not that familiar with Jane Eyre, so I'm going to kind of avoid that comparison. Betsy Connell, played by Frances D, is a Canadian nurse who is hired to take care of Jessica Holland, Christine Gordon, the wife of Paul Holland, played by Tom Conway, who is the owner of a sugar plantation on the Caribbean island of San Sebastian. I'm reading this off Wikipedia. She arrives in San Sebastian, which is populated by the descendants of African slaves and a small white community of doctors officials. Betsy is taken to Fort Holland, where she's told the story of how the Hollands brought the slaves to the island. And basically, that's where the story begins. She's taking care of an invalid woman who people believe has had some kind of brain injury due to a tropical fever she picked up, and is in a kind of somnambulistic zombie-like state, but it turns out that things aren't quite as simple as that. This movie is a joy to watch for a film buff. It really does have a lot of good stuff in it. First off, low budget. It was fairly low budget. RKO was not one of the big studios in Hollywood at the time, and the B-movie unit that Val Lewton ran didn't have a lot of bucks to throw at things. Of course, Cat People had been done on a micro budget. One of the great joys for me watching this film was the way that I realised watching it this time that the atmosphere, how the atmosphere is built up, the way that the dialogue, partly written by Kurt Siodmak, who had written Wolfman and did any number of other bits and pieces in the 1940s and 50s. Let's see what Kurt Siodmak did. Donovan's Brain, Beast with Five Fingers, Riders to the Sky. Fantastic stuff. Filmography, let's see. Son of Dracula, House of Frankenstein, Bride of the Gorilla, Magnetic Monster, Riders to the Stars, Creature with the Atomic Brain, Earth vs. the Flying Saucers. I mean, he was the go-to guy for a lot of this stuff. And it was written by him, somebody called Ardor Ray, and it was based on a bunch of Saturday Evening Post stories by a lady called Inez Wallace, who wrote a bunch of stories about Caribbean voodoo and zombies and things like that in the 1920s and 1930s. But anyway, the atmosphere is beautifully built up. After a while, it doesn't matter that this movie is filmed almost entirely on a set, except for a couple of particular scenes. The brilliance and the genius of the people making this film was the fact that they used that as a plus in a lot of the scenes. I'm just going to play a bit of audio from the movie now and come back and kind of talk about that a little bit more. Oh, Mary, come. Oh, Mary, come.
only a few days before I met Mr. Holland in Antigua. We boarded the boat for St. Sebastian. It was all just as I'd imagined it. I looked at those great glowing stars. I felt the warm wind on my cheek. I breathed deep, and every bit of me inside myself said, how beautiful.
It's not beautiful.
You read my thoughts, Mr. Holland.
It's easy enough to read the thoughts of a newcomer. Everything seems beautiful because you don't understand. Those flying fish, they're not leaping for joy. They're jumping in terror. Bigger fish want to eat them. That luminous water, it takes its gleam from millions of tiny dead bodies. The glitter of putrescence. There's no beauty here, only death and decay.
You can't really believe that.
Everything good dies here, even the stars.
It was strange to have him break in on my thoughts that way. There was cruelty and hardness in his voice. And yet something about him I liked. Something clean and honest. But hurt. Badly hurt.
That's a great setup scene because it sets up some of the themes to the film. In the background, you've got the sailors singing, and you introduce two of the main characters. Well, the nurse had already been introduced, but you introduced Mr. Holland, played by Tom Conway, and there's something tragic about him, but she's attracted to him as well. And the way he sees the world is, of course, coloured by the tragedy in his life and the medical condition of his wife. So all of that kind of gets conveyed in a very interesting way on that little scene on the boat in the film. And, of course, it's all studio-based, but it does start to bring you into this strange little world that's created by the movie where, and as I said before, they turn the negatives into a positive, as they had done with Cat People. There are some very important scenes in and around Fort Holland, the kind of compound where the Holland family lives. The mother, the two half-brothers, played by Tom Conway and James Ellison, and, of course, the wife, Jessica, who's in the somnambulistic state and is one of the two zombies in the film. And it's not too much of a giveaway to say that. But they turn... Most of the scenes there are at nighttime, and the use of shadow in this film and light is fantastic. They really took care, and in a way it disguises the fact that this is on a set in a really useful way. They turn that negative into such a positive where there are little shafts of light and shadows and strange places, and there's a fountain in the middle of the compound which is made from the figurehead of San Sebastian, one of the figureheads from the ships that brought the slaves to the island. And that figurehead's got water pouring over it and is a reminder of the history of the place and the cruelty and death and the history. Yeah, you know, basically the island itself becomes one of the characters in the movie. And they convey the history through dialogue among various characters. And everybody who lives on the island has that history as a part of their lives and as a part of who they are, in a way. So building up this fictitious island and its history and the people in it really does draw you into this tiny, strange and darkly magical world of I Walked with a Zombie. And that is something that you can't buy. You can't take that out of a box with CGI and chuck it into a film. It's something that people with great imagination and great talent and great skills and limited technology and limited time and limited budget brought to this film and really created it as a classic. I mean, what's 1943? So the thing's heading on for 80 years old now, or 70 years old. Mathematics isn't my strong suit. But the fact that we still value this kind of low-budget B-movie from that time is praise for it. And There's so many different aspects to this film that I enjoyed. I like the fact that, in a sense, it can be seen almost as a chick flick, with the female nurse coming to the island with a tragic male figure that she falls in love with, who has an ill wife, and there are mysteries and murder and magic and voodoo and all that sort of thing there. That can be seen as a chick flick. But it's not a chick flick in a way that alienates me as a guy. And a lot of chick flicks do. Because the story draws you in. The complexities of the characters draw you in. Just watching the movie as a piece of art is incredible. And there's iconic images in this film. Of course, the biggest one being Darby Jones playing Carrefour, the zombie. You know, a gaunt, half-naked black man with protuberant eyes. And that are kind of cataracted and glazed over. And he's incredibly striking, this guy. And the name itself is really, really interesting. And it's actually quite an important hint to the film as well. Carrefour in French is French for crossroads. So this man's at the crossroads of life and death, the zombie is. And, of course, the whole island is at that crossroads of the rationalist world where medical people are trying to cure this woman of her affliction. And the magic of the islanders, which really knows what's really going on and does move the plot along by their actions in regard to this. And one of the characters as well has a secret relationship with the natives and their belief systems. And one of the other great things about this film is the respect they have for those beliefs. They give them the same credence as they do science because of... And the non-white characters in the film are treated with respect. There's not a caricature of a black person in this film at all. There are no rolling eyes, step and fetch it, Rochester kind of characters. Well, there's a Rochester, but there's not the Jack Benny Rochester. And the people making the film, of course, didn't know this, but that respect for different ethnicities is something that makes this movie acceptable and accessible to us in the 21st century. The fact that they're slightly ahead of the curve of their time in regard to race relations, and that enriches the film in a way that a lot of contemporary films of the 1940s really fall foul of. I mean, you've only got to look at Gone with the Wind to have an example of that. And that's... I love that. That really does hearten me in a way that people, even in those days when race relations in America, and to be honest with you, in Australia, were nowhere near where we want them to be or wanted them to be these days. I'm explaining that badly, but we'll let it pass. But the fact that they did care enough about those issues to have that bottom line respect for people, it says something about humanity that I think is very important. And even though this is a B movie about supernatural voodoo in a Caribbean island, it gives me an immense goodwill towards the film. Even if it wasn't the brilliant thing it is, I would have goodwill towards this film because of that. I'm going to play another clip now, which is the other version of Shame and Scandal, done by Sir Lancelot, and just telling the history of the island and the history of the Holland family in a way that maybe the Holland family doesn't particularly like.
The wife and the brother, they want to go, but the Holland man, he tell them no. The wife fall down and the evil came, and it burned her mind in the fever flame.
Wes, we must get back to Fort Holland.
Shame and sorrow for the family. Her eyes are empty and she cannot talk, and the nurse has come to make her walk. The brothers are lonely and the nurse is young, and now you must see that my song is sung. Ah, woe ah me, shame and sorrow for the family. Ah, woe ah me. Shame and sorrow for the family.
That's fantastic stuff. Just him as the narrator who's commenting on the action of the film is a really interesting thing. I'm trying to think of modern films that create a world in the similar way to this film. I'm having a blind spot thinking of films that do create that kind of ambience where it exists in a bubble apart from the reality we know. And this film does that with incredibly subtle touches. It's the sound of the wind, and it's the people on the island, and it's what they see and how they believe, and the fact that the island people decided that their policeman was going to be a horse because they didn't really need a policeman. And all these weird little touches that take us out of what we know and the things we know about the world. And when the supernatural voodoo stuff comes along and Darby Jones comes along, we're really ready to accept that. We can go with it because they've taken us on the journey. They've drawn us in. They've seduced us. Remember when I was talking about Super 8 and E.T., where I love a movie that seduces me into its world, but I hate ones that try to manipulate my emotions. This is what I'm talking about. This is the kind of movie that draws you in subtly. It draws you in with little fine touches. It draws you in to a weird and interesting and ultimately tragic place in a way that movies seem to have lost the ability to do, which is horrible. I would love to have a film that brings you into a world the way this one does. There are a few of them. I mean, Let the Right One In does that in its own way. It brings you into that kind of dark, snowy world of the vampire in Let the Right One In. I don't know about Let Me In because I haven't seen that one yet, but Let the Right One In does it. So I suppose there are movies that do that and do it well, but any time a film does that, it really is a rich and lovely experience. Of course, there are movies that take us into a lot uglier worlds, torture porn, for instance, and things like that. For people to get the full visceral shock of a movie like that being drawn into the world's important. But I don't think it's done anywhere near as well as it is in this film. So that's about all I can really say about I Walk with a Zombie. My experience of it was that it's a masterpiece of imagination over budget and imagination over other physical limitations. And none of the actors in the film are fantastically brilliant actors, but they fit into the world of the film. And maybe that's an important takeaway from this, that you don't have to have the best actor in the world in a movie for the movie to be fantastically good. You have to have actors that are right for the film. Anyway, I'm going to take another break. Now, when I get back, I'm going to talk about another dark and night-bound movie, In a Lonely Place, directed by Nicholas Ray, starring Humphrey Bogart, Frank Lovejoy, and Gloria Graham.
Your kisses take me to Shangri-La. Each kiss is magic that makes my little world a Shangri-La. A land of bluebirds and fountains and nothing to do but cling to an angel that looks like you. And when you hold me, how warm you are. Be mine, my darling. Spend your life with me in Shangri-La. A land of bluebirds and fountains and nothing to do but cling to an angel that looks like you. And when you hold me, how warm you are. Be mine, my darling. Spend your life with me in Shangri-La.
I still say the way Newton sounds like a chick when he sings. That was Shangri-La from Wayne Newton from the Ultra Lounge Vegas Baby CD. The Ultra Lounge CDs are very cool. If you're into that kind of music at all, very, very nice collection of CDs to get. I've got them all, and I love them all. So, on to In a Lonely Place. Now, I've got to get this out of the way because gossip, of course, and celebrity gossip is my thing. And I've mentioned this before, where Gloria Grahame was married to Nicholas Ray, the director of this film, who was a bisexual gentleman and really an interesting director. I actually know somebody who used to be Nicholas Ray's assistant, quite a well-known science fiction writer, Melbourne-based, called Jack Dan, used to be Nicholas Ray's assistant. I haven't talked to him at all about Nick Ray, but anyway, leaving that aside, Nicholas Ray was married to Gloria Grahame. Nicholas Ray comes home from wherever he was one day. He may not have been at work, but wherever he was one day, found Gloria Grahame fucking his teenage son. This, of course, ended the relationship. And Gloria Grahame, years later, married the son. So I've always got that kind of awareness of Gloria Grahame as being a kind of film noir bad girl. Even though she doesn't particularly play it in this film, that knowledge of the actress and her real life stuff does spice my viewing of her as an actress in a film. So I find that interesting and a little bit icky in a way. So let's have a look at Nicholas Ray's filmography a bit. Interesting stuff. He did They Live by Night for RKO in 49. A Woman's Secret, which starred Gloria Grahame in 49 as well. Of course, this one, In a Lonely Place. On Dangerous Ground with Robert Ryan and Ida Lupino. Lupino actually directed some of that film when Nicholas Ray fell sick. An interesting little B film for RKO in 52 called Macau, with Robert Mitchum, Jane Russell, and William Bendix, which I really kind of like. Let's see, Johnny Guitar, of course, Rebel Without a Cause, Bigger Than Life with James Mason and Barbara Rush. I've got to do that for the podcast at some stage. And A Party Girl, an interesting film starring Robert Taylor and Sid Charisse, which I have a fondness for. He did things like, he did part of 55 Days at Peking, King of Kings, the Samuel Bronson biblical epic in 1961, which a lot of people at the time called I Was a Teenage Jesus, and didn't do too much else after that. He had his problems in life and became very much a film scholar and taught other people how to do it in his later life. But this is one of Bogart's darkest roles. It really is. It's an interesting piece of work. I'll just talk a little bit about the plot of the film to give you a bit of background on it. This is from Wikipedia again. Bogart stars as Dixon Steele, a cynical screenwriter suspected of murder. Gloria Grahame co-stars as Laurel Gray, a neighbor who falls under his spell. Well, they fall in love, so it's not a spell. Beyond the surface plot of confused identity and tormented lust, the film was a mordant comment on Hollywood mores and the pitfalls of celebrity and near celebrity, in much in the same vein as blah, 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 blah. It is one of Bogart's finest performances, mostly because, and Bogart was very, very aware of this and very kind of leery of this. Bogart, as a man, liked to prod and stir people a bit. And Dixon Steele in this film prods and stirs people. He, of course, Bogart wasn't anywhere near the quick-tempered and violent character that Dick Steele is in this. But he didn't want people to think he was. So it was one of those things where he was very ambivalent about the role, but he is very, very good in this film. And he portrayed, the character's an interesting one too, and he's the centre of the film. The Gloria Grahame character who falls in love with him is secondary to this. But he supports his friends. He's got a ageing drunk actor friend who he called Charlie, who he's very close to. He's a little bit of a kind of John Barrymore character in the film. And you know, Dixon still is kind of, he hasn't had a hit since before the war. He's kind of a screenwriting, and he doesn't want to kind of go the commercial route. He only wants to write projects he's interested in and tries to take the moral high ground with that. But ultimately, it's affecting his viability as a screenwriter in Hollywood. And it's only when he does get involved with Gloria Graham's character in the film, Laurel Gray, that he actually takes on a screenplay for a movie, for an adaptation of a book that he doesn't particularly like, because he seems to be able to cope with that ambiguity of the artist versus the commercial, because he's in love and he's happy and he really does have that. Even though there is still hanging over his head the fact that he's suspected of the murder of a girl he takes back to his apartment. The girl has just read the book that he has to adapt, and he hasn't actually agreed yet to adapt that film. So he takes her back to his room, pays her some money, and gets her to tell him the story of the book to see whether he actually wants to do it or not. He then gives her some money to take a cab home, tells her there's a cab rank around the corner, but she doesn't get home and she's killed. And he, of course, is the prime suspect because she's been at his apartment and nobody has seen her since then. Anyway, I'm going to play a little bit of the kind of upside to Dixon Steele. This is the dialogue, the kind of meet-cute dialogue between Bogart and Gloria Graham in this film. It goes a little bit long, this clip, but I kind of like the writing in it. I like the way that they're playing it and the flirtation between the characters that is one aspect of the two kind of sides to the story and the characters in this film.
Oh, come in. Mr. Lipman, my agent, Miss Gray, my alibi.
Hello.
Good morning. He believes I killed Mildred Atkinson.
Stop it, will you?
You want a cup of coffee?
No, thanks. I came down to ask if you could keep my name and address out of the papers. I thought you might have some connections.
Well, I don't have, but Mel here has. That is, if you want to go to Mexico.
Shut up. It's much easier to get people's names into papers than to keep them out.
Well, you've managed to keep mine out a few times. Go ahead, Mel. See what you can do.
Well, I'll try, but I can't promise anything. Miss Gray, did you really see him after that girl left?
Of course I did.
Sometimes I wish I'd never met you. But I'm very happy to have met you.
The best straight man I ever had.
You must have really upset him.
Yeah, when I told him I killed Mildred, he practically had me across the border.
Very funny.
No, it's not very funny. It's a good thing you like my face. I'd have been in a lot of trouble without you.
I only told the police what I saw. I have no idea what you did after you closed your Venetian blinds.
Oh, you'd be surprised. I went to bed. Perhaps I shouldn't have closed my blinds. You know, Miss Gray, you're one up on me. You can see into my apartment, but I can't see into yours.
I promise you, I won't take advantage of it.
Oh, I would if it were the other way around. I'd try to find out who you're hiding from.
Not hiding, just avoiding.
Couldn't by any chance be Mr. Baker, the real estate Mr. Baker.
Could be.
You mean you picked up your little marbles, I hope?
We were thinking of getting married. It wouldn't have worked.
You sneaked out the back door and left no forwarding address.
That about covers it. Only it was my back door.
You know, you're out of your mind. How could anybody like a face like this? Look at it.
I said I liked it. I didn't say I wanted to kiss it.
No, you're a quitter. A get out before you get hurt type.
Is that bad?
Well, I suppose you save yourself a lot of trouble that way.
I do. I think twice before I get into something.
You're getting into something right now.
No, I'm not. I've only thought about it once.
You a fast thinker?
Not right now. I didn't get much sleep last night. A neighbor kept me awake.
Well, go ahead and get some sleep and we'll have dinner together tonight.
We'll have dinner tonight, but not together.
You know, when you first walked into the police station, I said to myself, there she is, the one that's different. She's not coy or cute or corny.
She's a good guy. I'm glad she's on my side. She speaks her mind and she knows what she wants.
Thank you, sir. But let me add, I also know what I don't want, and I don't want to be rushed.
Well, when you've made up your mind, stop by. But not before noon.
Thank you. I will. Your phone's ringing.
Oh.
Play that clip for a very specific reason. And the reason is it shows that Dixon Steele is a likable person. The character himself is likable to us. We really shine to him. He's witty. He's smart. He's got a certain stance on film and the films he'll get involved with. But he also has this explosive and irrational temper. And when he expresses that, when that explodes out of him, as an audience member, you feel bad for him. It's like having a very close and dear friend who does something incredibly stupid and self-destructive. You have that kind of relationship with the Dixon Steele character in this film. And Gloria Graham's character is interesting too. She left her previous fiancé by slipping out the door, in a sense. And later on in the film, you do see that consistency in her behaviour there. And that kind of fleshes out the character. And Gloria Graham is superb in this film. It's not the film for which she won an Oscar. That was one of my favourite films, of course. The Bad and the Beautiful, where she had the supporting role as the wife of the William Powell character in the film. But in this one, she's smart, she's sexy, she's knowing. And she's been around just enough to be... She's attracted to Dixon Steele, but as you heard in that clip, she's kind of wants to stand off for a little bit and just observe him. And the arc of the film comes from that, in a sense, because there's an ultimate tragic ending to this film. There was originally going to be an ending, and without spoiling the ending that exists in the film now, I'll tell you what the ending was. The originally filmed ending to this film, which the studio insisted upon, was that Dixon Steele has an argument with Laurel and kills her. And then his friend Brubb, who's a policeman, comes in to tell him he's been cleared of the previous murder and finds her dead and arrests him for the murder of Laurel. That's not the ending that's in the film. There's a different ending in the film, which is a little, if it can be said, darker in its own way than that ending that I just mentioned. In its own way, it's a much more, it's something more relatable for the audience than the murder ending. It's something that's happened to a number of us. It's a kind of realistic ending that is a gut punch at the end of the film. And I find that really worthwhile. Nick Ray, Humphrey Bogart, the cameraman, and Gloria Graham filmed the ending that we now get in this film with everybody else out of the studio because they wanted their ending on the film. They didn't want the studio's ending. I'm not sure how that worked out, how they got it past the studio, but they didn't want to have a kind of cliched, dark film noir ending. They wanted something with a little more of an adult approach and a little more ambiguity in it. And as I said before, this film is very cynical about Hollywood. There's a kind of glad-handing, slightly overweight and quite nasty guy in the film who is the son of a big producer and has just made a very successful film and basically is an asshole. And, of course, there are any number of sons and son-in-laws of producers who became producers themselves in Hollywood. You know, you could guess who they're referring to in that particular thing. There are there's a director in the film who's very successful because he keeps remaking the same story in each one of his films. There are a number of directors at the time you can relate that to. And of course, there's an ex-girlfriend of Dixon Steele, who is... I love the fact that this has got some strong and interesting roles for female characters. The murder victim in the film, Mildred Atkinson, is played by an oddly named actress, Martha Stewart. Is an interesting character in herself. She's not very educated, but she's an avid reader, and she reads lowbrow material. and she gets the name of the characters slightly wrong, mispronounces them. But she's enthusiastic about the book and she loves the story. And I think one of the reasons why Dixon Steele kind of likes her, even though he's slightly condescending towards her, is that even though she's reading a trashy book, even though she's, by the way she talks, she's not very educated, the fact that she's passionate about the story is something that he likes. And he does the right thing. He sends her back to, sends her back home with some money for helping him out. And she's not the kind of woman that he's attracted to, in other words. But ultimately, she is the engine of the plot in her death. But they've got her as an interesting character. There's also a really weird little bit in this film, I should mention that, where Laurel is getting a massage from a kind of butch lesbian masseuse, which is quite interesting, and it's fairly obvious from the way things roll out in the film that this masseuse is very attracted to Laurel. It's just a little bit, and obviously she's some kind of maid servant or something to the Laurel character. The relationship's not really fleshed out in the film, but a bit of an interesting one there as well, which kind of gives Laurel someone to talk about her relationship to Dixon Steele with. And, of course, she's incredibly attracted to him. She's in love with him, but the fact that he's such a violent character, the fact that she doesn't know whether he killed Mildred Atkinson or not, is what ultimately leads to the ending that we have in the film. But this film is fascinating for the kind of undercurrents of Bogart's character in this one. It's really dark, but Humphrey Bogart carries a lot of baggage with him when we see him in a film. We know him as Rick in Casablanca. We know him from High Sierra. We know him from all the other wonderful films that he did. But with Dixon Steele, he takes the character to a slightly different area and plays on the tough guy in as he sees the essential violence and the ability to take care of himself that tough guys have in movies. In this movie, it's portrayed as a negative thing. It's something that's fucking this guy up big time and ultimately leads to him losing something of great value to him, somewhat of great value to him. And that's an interesting place to take a tough guy actor in. Realistically, Bogart died in 1957, so this is in the last 7 years of his life, and he'd been acting since the late 1930s. But to take somebody with such a tough guy persona in film and then say, okay, the persona is a negative, that toughness, that ability to punch people out when they piss you off, is something that maybe isn't in your own best interest. So that beautiful ambiguity there. And this, again, is a lovely film in black and white. It was restored a few years ago as well, digitally. The originals had a lot of flaws and a lot of cracks and a lot of problems with them, and they took the care to restore the film, and it does look good. If anybody ever had any doubts about the virtues of computer technology, and of course none of us do because we download podcasts, the fact that people can restore to an amazing degree films of the past that are unavailable in a pristine condition, and the sound's muddy, and particularly the end of the reels, the sound in this film was a bit problematic for the people doing the restoration. The fact that they can do that with these films now and, in a sense, take them back to where they were in quality is pretty cool. They did a Bridge on the River Kwai, as I mentioned at the start of the podcast, bringing that back to a clarity. So the movie Bridge on the River Kwai, one of the amazing things about the Blu-ray version of that, just to digress for a moment, is the fact that you could see that in the crowd scenes with the guys in the prison camp, they got a whole bunch of Sri Lankan people in the background dressed up like English soldiers and things to fill out the numbers. They didn't have enough Anglos to chuck in there, that in the background they've got a whole bunch of Asian faces. And I hadn't noticed that any time in the film before, but now that we've got this clear, sharp, digitized Blu-ray of the film, you can see that, and it makes it a more interesting viewing experience than otherwise. But anyway, that's the end of the digression. But this is definitely one of the great later Bogart films. There's another one from about a few years after this, about 1954, called The Barefoot Contessa, which has Ava Gardner in it, which I like Bogart's character in that too. He plays a kind of less dark version of Dixon Steele in a way, and he's in a good marriage, and there's some nice bright and witty dialogue in it as well. And the fact that he, in his later career, played these kind of characters is pretty damn cool. And when I say in his later career, the thing that just struck me then is Bogart made The Barefoot Contessa when he was my age, so I've just suddenly got all depressed about how old I am. But anyway, In a Lonely Place, one of the great Nicholas Ray films, one of the great Bogart movies, and an incredibly interesting film noir. It really does have what we love in that genre. And, you can't watch a movie like this, or indeed like I Walk with a Zombie, without having your love of film refreshed. I haven't seen these films in a few years, and I've come back on them now. And it's heartening, and it's a really lovely thing to go, okay, here's the good stuff again. These guys who made this, and women, of course, these guys, using it in a broader term, really had the chops, and they've given me something that I find of value, and I find entertaining, and I find that it makes me want to know more about how these things were made. So, I mean, I'm doing the radio gig. I've got a 3-week hiatus on the radio gig. But doing the radio gig every week, I've got to talk about a different film and get everything together for a different film. There is a tendency, and even though I love doing this, and I wouldn't give it up unless they throw me out. When they eventually throw me out, I'll give it up. But the discipline of doing a movie a week and then two for the podcast, there's a tendency that you can get a bit over it, even though it's something you love. But seeing these two films and seeing Bridget on the River Kwai this week has brought me back from that. Maybe I was kind of going low rent in the films. And, of course, the Tin Man movies as well. It's kind of brought me back to that love and reminded me why I love movies. And feeling very lucky and feeling very fortunate that my perceptions are honed to whatever degree they're honed. And I'm not anywhere near the film buff of a Roger Ebert or a Kim Newman or anybody like that is. But having my perceptions honed enough that I can take more out of a film than some other people choose to really is a gift. And I don't know what it's a gift from. Maybe it's a gift from luck or a gift from the universe. Whatever it's a gift from, I find that really heartening. And this kind of leads me nicely into the feedback. 4th anniversary of the podcast, and we do have some feedback. So I'm going to take another little break at now, play a little bit more of something that I grabbed off YouTube, and come back with feedback.
I always thought I was a very worldly guy, insensitive to childish thoughts of love. Lately I've been acting like a kid with apple pie since you gave my stoic heart a shove. You're a snooty little cutie, you're a pert little skirt, you're a knockout, you're a beauty, you're a flirt. You're a dapper little flapper, you're just as cute as a trick. You're a kissy little missy, a vain little Jane, you're slick. You're a classy little lassie, you're a keen little queen. And although sometimes you're sassy and you're mean, I am a fiend for romance with you. Squirrely little girlie, you're fine. You're a knockout, you're a beauty, snooty little cutie mine. sassy little lassie. You're a keen little queen. You've the smoothest little chassis I've ever seen. I am a fiend for romance with you. Squirrely little girlie, you're fine. You're a knockout, you're a beauty. Snooty little cutie, snooty, snooty little cutie mine.
That was Bobby Troup with Snooty Little Cutie. Bobby Troup is an interesting character. Not only did he write the song Route 66, but he was married to Julie London in the days when Julie London was muy caliente. So anyway, on to feedback. The first one we got is from Morris. He sent me an email and a voicemail, but I'll play his email first. I'll read his email first. I've actually played it in my head, but I will read it. He says, "Hey Terry, I must say that having music in the background over your opening remarks in the latest episode of Paleo Cinema was a very good move. Quite enjoyed that. Also, I hope you make closing this show with a song a regular occurrence. Going in a similar line to your Lee Remick song, you should check out a song by Melbourne-based songwriter Charles Jenkins called Shelley Winters. It's absolutely beautiful and anyone, any film fan should listen to. You can hear the song at, and I'll post the YouTube clip on the Paleo-Cinema website. If you're still contemplating films for the I part, may I suggest The Icicle Thief? I tracked it down, will be happy to pass it on if you want. Let me know. Cheers, Morris." No, I didn't go with The Icicle Thief. I did go, of course, with what I went with. Did I mention that this is part of the A to Z project? If not, this week's podcast is the I part of the A to Z project. Next time, it's J's. But I want to try to squeeze in an episode with a guest before then. And I just got to get my shit together to do it. But, The Icicle Thief would have been a good choice. But the problem with doing the A to Z project, it isn't, well, it's the kind of problem we should have. And it's a problem that I have an embarrassment of riches in any letter of the alphabet eyes. I mean, I was considering doing the Ipcress file. There are a whole bunch of different I films that I Walked the Line would be another one that I could have done. So there are a whole bunch of I films that I could have done. J's are going to be interesting, so I'm looking forward to doing that. But you can't do everything. It'd be an endless nightmare to try to do everything that I really wanted to in any particular letter of the alphabet. I could go back over the A to I that I've done so far and pick maybe 100 films out of that lot that would have gone really well in the podcast. And one of the things I find, which is crazy for me, is that just after I've done a particular letter, I'll think, oh, fuck, I should have done that film. And that's infuriating. And, of course, a learning experience as well for future reference. But thank you for that. Now let's just see what I've got here.
"Good afternoon, evening, morning, whatever time you're listening, Paleo Cinema. This is Morris Pyshkinski calling here to wish you a happy 4th anniversary on your podcast of Paleo Cinema. And I think it's a very bizarre thing that I have to call an American number for an Australian podcast, a Melbourne-based podcast. I'm in the same town as you, Terry, and I have to call 10,000 miles to wish you all the best. But nevertheless, I'm doing so. I've been enjoying your podcast now for some months. And, may I continue to enjoy them, and may you continue to point out some wonderful films for mine and the listeners' enjoyment and edification. Okay, cheers. Be well."
Thanks, Morris. I'm really touched that you actually bothered to call the American number from Melbourne just to leave me a message. That's a very sweet thing to do, and thank you very much for that. You could have sent me an MP3 as an email for future reference, but love that you did that, and I really appreciate the feedback and things. We've got to do a meetup on stage at the moment. Just don't know what my schedule is going to be like at all with all the renos that I'm doing and when the radio comes back on, doing that kind of thing. It does take on the time, and of course Sal's been a little unwell, and we've kind of got to deal with that as a separate issue. But anyway, thank you very, very much for that. I always appreciate it. It's really interesting for me because most of my audience is across the ocean, and having people in the same town as me who listen to the podcast is for me more than a lot of other podcasters I know in Melbourne, an unusual experience. But thank you very much for that, and I do hope I continue to be worthy of your attention. Next up, we got an email from our old friend Rickster. I won't read all of it because some of it's kind of technical about podcasting. But he says, "Hi, Terry. Sorry I haven't been following behind with feedback for Paleo Cinema. I'm running behind about 3 or 4 episodes, but I'm still trying my best not to let life get on top of me, and hopefully I'll be able to catch up before you reach the letter Z, or in your case, probably Z." And that's basically it. I won't go into all the technical stuff. Until then, I'm very glad to hear that Sal's doing better and also about the kitchen renovation. I wish you two all the best and can't wait to catch up on my Paleo Cinema listening. Take care, Rickster. Thank you for that, Rickster. I really appreciate it. You've been a fan of Paleo Cinema for years now. And love your feedback. And thank you as well for your attention, mate. Okay, I've got an email from Paul. I don't know whether you want your last name read out, Paul. If you don't mind, tell me for future. Sorry, also known as Quint. Hi, Terry. Just writing to say congratulations on the 4th anniversary of your marvellous podcast. I love your movie choices and your reviews are always informative and entertaining. Must be hard work doing a single-person podcast, and yours is one of the best. Also, gotta love the feedback from Zom. You're doing a great job, Terry. I'm loving the A to Z project. Keep it up. Best wishes, Quint. Thanks for that, Quint. The funny thing is that doing a solo podcast is what I know. And no, I'm going to be bringing more and more guests in. There are no two ways about that. The episode I did was almost fantastic. Getting Sal in occasionally is a joy to me. And I've got a lineup of people here in Melbourne and elsewhere that I really want to get on and have a chat with and kind of groove with that kind of a vibe as well. My intention is to alternate between the solo and guest podcasts. So that I've really got to get my shit together with. But yeah, as far as doing a solo podcast, it's what I know. It's the format that I'm most familiar with. I mean, shit, I've done 85 now. Well, 84 if you count the one with Zom as a dual podcast. And I'm used to it. I'm not going to get in a comfort zone because I think when we get into a comfort zone with something like this, that's when the quality deteriorates. So I'm trying not to be too much into a comfort zone and stretch myself with the movies that I'm doing. And I will have guests in here. But yeah, essentially this is my gig. I don't want to get too precious about that. But I'm going to really love having other people involved with it. And it never occurs to me that it's hard because it's what I know. Anyway, moving right along, he said, bringing up the email window. Got one last piece from Christopher Martin. Chris Martin. Hi, Terry. Congratulations on reaching the 4-year mark with Paleo Cinema. Have been listening for a couple of years, but I'm not too hot on getting around to feedback. Powered through the first couple of years worth in no time, scribbling movie titles on whatever came to hand on my walk to work. Now that I have to wait for new podcasts, I saved them for a quiet Sunday afternoon walks down to the seafront. Thank you for introducing me to so many great movies. Hope you keep podcasting for as long as there are movies to talk about, Chris. Thanks, Chris. I'm glad it enriches your walks. I mean, I listen to a lot of podcasts while I'm walking as well. I think it's that and commuting are the perfect formats for podcasts. They do keep your attention, but they don't take it away from what you're doing as much as they would say if you were doing heart surgery or listening to a podcast. But yeah, it's nice to hear where people are listening to the podcast, well, what they're doing while they're listening. I always find that a bit interesting. I've got the Geostats thing where I can find out where people are who are downloading it. And for some reason, I'm getting a lot of listeners in China, or at least a lot of downloaders in China. So if you're in China, drop me a line, send me an email. If I have to put it through a Google translation thing, I'll do it. But yeah, it's interesting that I'm actually getting that. And I do hope that it's not just computer hackers who are downloading it for nefarious purposes or something in China, which of course is stereotyping an entire nation of over 1 billion people, and I probably shouldn't do that. But I'm getting a lot of people increasingly in Asia. I'm getting a lot, of course, in North America and Europe. Increasing numbers in Australia and New Zealand, and not too much in Africa, and a lot more in South America and Central America and the Caribbean as well. So that's a bit interesting. So that's about it for the feedback. I've got one last piece of feedback that somebody put on my copy of Audacity while she was re-recording the intro this evening. So I'll just play that. I'll come back, I'll say goodbye, and then I'll play some music to see us out.
Hi, listeners. This is Sally Frost, Terry's long-suffering wife. I'd just like to take this opportunity to wish Terry a happy 4th anniversary for Paleo Cinema Podcast. It's been an interesting 4 years in our life, and I'm glad that Terry has this podcast. At least I get left alone once a fortnight to do my own thing while he's locked up the back of the house with the library in the library. Anyway, Terry, congratulations. Keep up the good work. You've done really well, babe, and you deserve all successes in life. Bye.
So on that very icky, lovey-dovey note, that's about it for number 85. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with 86. We're slowly, incrementally creeping up on the 100th edition of the podcast, which I'm looking forward to, whatever it brings. I want to get a whole bunch of people on that one. So what I might do, this is the tentative plan for 100, people who listen to the podcast know my tentative plans take a while to get this shit together. I want to get a... basically have a chat with as many people as I can get on Skype about Paleo Cinema, so that maybe the whole episode is going to be me shooting this shit with various podcasters and listeners via Skype and just having an ongoing chat as a little piecemeal thing with a whole bunch of people rather than just shooting shit solo about movies. So it's going to be the most other person intensive Paleo Cinema. That's the plan at this stage, so I may have to start lining people up sometime in the next year or so. It's not that many. It's probably going to be sometime in early 2012, before the apocalypse, the Paleo Cinema gets to its 100th anniversary. Anyway, I'm going to now leave you with an art piece of music by Peter Cook and Dudley Moore, and take care of yourselves. Enjoy your movie watching. Hope you don't trip over if you're listening to this while you walk. And I'll be back in 2 weeks.
Now is the time to say goodbye. Goodbye. Now is the time to yield the sigh.
Oh, yield that sexy sigh, baby doll.
Now is the time to wend away.
Let's wend.
Until we meet again. Some sunny day. A goodbye, goodbye, we're leaving you, Skindigan. A goodbye, we wish you fond goodbye, Father Totter, a Father Lotter. A goodbye, goodbye, we're leaving you, Skindigan. A goodbye, we wish you fond goodbye, Father Totter, Totter. La la, 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 la.
Ladies and gentlemen, we'd like to thank the British Glue Corporation for all their help in my moustache, and thank you very much for looking in.
A goodbye. We wish a fond day.